You are listening to Read It, Roll It, Hole It.
He's 2 punts from victory.
Only needs one.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We've got special guest today, Aaron Holtom. Aaron is a good friend of mine. We've known each other for a few years. He's a pro up at Morley Hayes up north, isn't it? It's north of Birmingham, so it's got to be up north. But no, he's a great guy. Welcome, Aaron.
Cheers, Ollie. Thanks for having me on. Much appreciated.
No problem. No problem at all. I really look forward to our conversation today. And this podcast is going to be slightly different today, where you've actually done a master's degree and you sort of specialized it on the difference between chipping and pitching. So we're going to sort of share with the listeners what you sort of set out and did and what your findings were. And hopefully we'll have a fun discussion and everyone enjoys it.
Oh, fantastic. Brilliant. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Awesome. Okay, so like Aaron, just give us like a bit of an overview to start with. Why on earth did you want to do this?
Well, I mean, the Masters was one thing I wanted to do. I just wanted to keep on getting better. I thought I'm not very academic and it was a great way for me to get out of my comfort zone. And then what made me choose the pitching and the chipping as a topic really was the fact that I've got a Ball 3D system, one of Mark Ball's 3D motion capture systems. And I thought it would be a great opportunity to really get into the nitty gritty of how you can use that for research, just to improve my whole understanding as well of an area that hasn't had that much, you know, work on it. And the short game, there's loads of research about how we can increase distance and loads of laboratory settings on how to increase club head speed, different things like that. But there's very, very little research on how the best players chip and pitch. So I thought it'd be a good way to learn something about an under-researched area.
Love it. Exciting. We're both sort of very fortunate to have Mark Bull as mentors. He's a pretty cool cat, isn't he?
Oh yeah, he's brilliant. He's been very good to me, and I've been away with him in Canada and in Scotland, and he's helped me meet a lot of cool people, so I've got a lot to thank him for. Yeah, I love him.
Great stuff. And like before we start, and like this might be diving in too early, but like for the listeners, can you define the difference between a chip and a pitch? What's your definition of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I suppose when I did my PGA training, a pitch was a short shot that would spend more time in the air than on the ground. And a chip would be classed as the opposite. So a shot that spent more time rolling than in the air. And when you kind of look into the academic side of it, they don't use those terms because it's very hard to know, you know, if you're 100 yards out and you're behind a tree and you hit it really low and it rolls 80 yards, we wouldn't really call that a chip. So what instead we use the terms partial shots. And that's very clear. You know, it's my research looked at 15 yard and 50 yard partial shots, which are just something less than full swing. And other people would call the real short game. They split it into finesse wedge shots, which are the shots around the green, and your distance wedge shots, which is your more like your 30, 40, 80 yard shot. So it's a great question. I had about 15 different names for the title of my research and settled on partial shots for those reasons.
Love it. Okay, that's cool. It's an interesting one, isn't it? I think, even that could be debated for hours, just that what's the difference, and that's, for another day maybe. So talk me through then, Aaron, like the sort of main way you ran it, and what were how did you sort of test golfers and who did you test, and then like the key findings. Give us like an overview of what you did and what you figured out.
Yeah, so I mean, as a background, when you look at what we call segment interactions, which is another way of what we commonly known as, or within golf coaches, it's called the kinematic sequence, famously put by TPI, they used that term, is kind of how the segments, which is the parts of the body, the pelvis, the rib cage, or the thorax, the arm, and the club, and the hand, and how they interact. So on the downswing, how they rotate. And we can, it's pretty well established that for big full shots, we have this thing called a proximal to distal sequence, where the middle of the body moves first, so the from the center the energy moves out, so the pelvis would turn back towards the target first on the downswing, then the rib cage, then the lead arm, and they'd all follow this pattern as well, where they reach their peak speed. So the pelvis would go turn first towards the target, and it would go fastest first before slowing down, and then at impact the club head reaches its maximum speed at the ball. And I hope that
for me, absolutely, yeah, I think it's you know, as you said, well documented that the good players tend to move in that sort of way. But I've no idea what they do for chipping and pitching, so I'm looking forward to hearing.
Yeah, so and that's it, really. It's pretty well documented that that would be an ideal sequence. But in reality, you know, there's players on the tour that don't have that sequence. And there's even further research that would say that for the players that do have that perfect ideal sequence, they only do it a certain percentage of the time. So there was a little bit of work done, and one author, Tim Mark, he said that there was a proximal to distal sequencing on 40, 55, and I think it was 70 meter or 60 meter wedge shots. And then there was other people that came out and said that it wasn't there on the short parcel shots. Yeah, so what I did, basically, I wanted to find out, well, what was it? And this is the mistake, first mistake I made, really, was what is the sequence? What should it be? So I captured 10 swings from the best players that I could get my hands on, which were kind of mini tour players. And, you know, they were, nearly all the players that I captured were either scratch, very close to scratch, or touring professionals who play for a living. And I had them hit 10 shots to two targets, 50 and a 15-yard shot. And what I was looking for was to see, well, what was the pattern? What was their sequence? And if there was a difference between the ones that were really good at something and the ones that weren't so good, what was the difference there?
Cool. And what did you find?
Well, what would you think? So would you expect, if I throw this one back out to you, what do you think you would expect to see? Would there be any differences between a 15-yard and a 50-yard shot? And would you expect it to be different for those two? Just,
I would probably expect some sort of tendency or pattern to be a similar to the long game. But yeah, it probably gets more random the closer they get, maybe.
Yeah, so I thought that came up. That definitely came up. So, yeah, you could really categorise the findings into two parts, really. The first was that they were statistically different in when the pelvis moved and how the pelvis moved. So with a 50-yard shot, the pelvis moved back towards the target much earlier. In the downswing. So it peaked earlier. So the peak speed was earlier, and it moved more towards the target. And
so just
as
explain,
well as,
so the peak speed of the pelvis on the downswing was before impact?
It was before impact for both. But if you think of the transition that, the transition order, so it was more like what you just said there, like a full swing where the pelvis would go first. On some of the other shots, when you looked at all of the shots as a whole, and you put in all those shots that the players hit, it was statistically significant that the pelvis transitioned earlier when you looked at the group as a whole.
Transitioned,
as well,
got
as
you.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Okay. It's not, doesn't sound that exciting, but when you look at it on camera, you can see that. What was not so, which was more of a surprise, was the fact that I was looking for these players to display a dominant pattern, and that really wasn't present. So, you know, the players would have different orders, different transition orders, and different peaking orders for the same shot, even though they were hitting the same shot over and over again, because they hit 10 shots in a row to the two targets. And that was quite a surprise. You know, the academic word would be inter and intra variability. So although the outcome was very similar for these players, you know, how they moved the club and how they moved their body in transition was different. And for some players, it was different on almost every trial.
Did the order change, the kinematic sequence change, or did the peak velocity time?
When you compare the chip to the pitch, there was a little bit of difference when you looked at them as groups. The pelvis moved earlier to the left, and it peaked earlier in the sequence. And when you looked at each player against its own shot, there wasn't, you know, player A didn't have a 1-2-3-4-5 and a 1-2-3-4. It was very quite sporadic, which was a big surprise to me.
I would have thought the sequence would have stayed the same. Sure, they're going to move slightly different speeds, but Mark has taught us that he talks about like postural sway, doesn't he? So like movement is never going to be the same every single time, but the sequence changed.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it changed a lot more for the, you said this on the introduction, for the chip shot, you know, it changed a lot more than for the 50 yard pitch. The 50 yard pitch was a little bit more, you know, I think 45% of the shots were gathered into two orders in transition, let's say. So you could group, 45% of the shots into just two categories for the transition, but you couldn't. It was a much smaller number when you tried to categorize the top two most used sequence for the chip shot. This is one thing I'd like to throw back to you then, because I've used this, I've seen the Sam Putlab used, and they were, when I used it, not with yourself, they were big on this consistency number. So do you want to just explain what you know about the consistency number on Sam Putlab and yeah.
Yeah, so
what's that?
So the Sam Putlab measures the club in putting, and it predicts the ball, and it analyzes 28 different parts. And you can use the Sam Putlab by recording 10 putts, and then it will work out a mean, like an average of what that movement was. So let's say face aim. So it'll work out what the average face aim is, and then how often you aimed there would be the consistency. So like if you aimed like one putt 3 degrees left and one putt, the next putt was 3 degrees right, it would say your consistency is pretty poor, because yes, there's a big variation in the move. So like, that number probably is more important than the actual number for me, because it's like, if they say, if a player aims 1 degree right and then has a pull bias and they close it 1 degree every time or most of the time, then like, if it's pretty consistent, then you probably wouldn't look at changing it. So like Tiger Woods, for example, on Sam Putlab, he aims 2 degrees right. use a lot of his sort of his trail forearm, and goes into sort of a pronation and closes, has a high closure rate, and closes and hooks his putts or pulls his putts, if you like. So like, if you would fix his aim, I reckon he would be worse. So
yeah,
it's understanding the, for me, the patterns and the tendencies and how that changes then on left to right and right to left. And through my testing, I've not done any master's degrees, but I've done a lot of testing with Capto and Sam on how players' techniques change on left to right and right to left. And sometimes it can be completely different. So like they'll have a push bias on a right to left and a pull bias on a left to right. Then it's like, whew, like,
yeah,
it can really start, you know, you start to sort of, yeah, you need to delve into a lot more detail, really, rather than just sort of looking at a number and saying, yeah, that's a good number. Good for what, really, is my sort of response to that.
Yeah. So that would be a consistency on face aim. And is there a number that would be the consistency of all of the data, or am I just making that up?
No, there is. It scores you. So basically, the Sam Putt Lab reports, they got a database, I think, of 150 tour players, and they've worked out a mean of what the average of those 150 do. So if you manage to score the same as a tour player, then you'll get, like, you know,
yeah,
a good score. So
I see.
I don't use the numbers. I take them off the screen because I don't want players to think, you know, if it comes up red and it says you're 30% at that,
it might
not be good for them. So I guess similar to yours, like that database, like Tiger Lane 2 degrees right, and then you've got the next pro, like Rory aims 2 degrees left. So the mean, the average for the two is zero, but neither of them aim at zero. So it's,
yes,
yeah.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, but they move very different down to their concept. Tiger puts a lot with his right hand. You know, Rory used to try and sort of hold the club towards the target. So that they move very different for sort of.
Yes.
It's
the reason the reason I brought that up is because when I was fit, you know, it was a surprise to me that these players moved, you know, I originally thought that you start doing a little bit of reading around variability, and there's a recent research that comes out that says that we used to think that variability or changes in the movement were poor, and we tried to eliminate them. And now there seems to be evidence that this variability, or the how these players are adapting, is a sign of a successful player. And I stumbled upon one piece of research by Richardson, Hughes, and one other fella. And they looked at putting, and they were anticipating that the best putters they captured would have less variability in their movement. So they had a 3D motion capture system on them. And what they found, that although the best player that they tracked or measured had very low variability, but some of the other players had high variability in their movements but were much more successful than some of the others that were really, really less variable. And it's just a really interesting topic for me, I think, that a lot of the players that you see, they're trying to do the same thing time and time and time again. And there's not much evidence that the best players do swing the same each time or even put the same each time. And certainly from my research, when they're chipping, you know, they really are adapting to the last shot and the environment as they go.
Hmm. Yeah, Mark talks a lot, doesn't he, about repetition without repetition. Is that what he says? Something along those lines. And he talks about the guy, the goldsmith, or he was like hammering at a rock, and he hits the same target every single time, but moves a very different way through his elbow and shoulder and wrist every single time. The movement's very different, but the result's the same every time, which is he smashes the rock in where he's looking, where he's placing his attention.
That's it. That's it. And that really is kind of sums up my the main part of the research that I, and there's obviously other stuff there that other things that I've noticed myself, but the main points are that the sequence is definitely different between a pitch and a chip, with the pelvis being the main thing that stands out. And then the second is that there's high amounts of variability between these, between the players and even between themselves, from trial to trial. And that's the major findings.
I think that's fascinating, really, because it's, yeah, it comes back to, I love my Sandpit Lab, and, you know, that there's other measuring devices out there for the long game that put parameters that golfers should be in between. And what you're sort of finding is that's not necessarily true, because we're all different. We're all unique and individual. We all move in different ways, and we move a different way ourselves every single time, which is crazy, yeah. Isn't it? And Phil Kenyon's a mentor of mine, and he has got access to a database of, I think, 100 tour players who have been measured in 3D. And for example, I think people say take the wrists out of putting. So there's not one of those 100 golfers who do not use a degree of freedom in the, you know, pronation, supination, the forearm or radial ulnar deviation or flexion extension. There's not one player who has 0 degrees of freedom in their wrists. And I think his findings, everyone moves the same, you know. Mark will say, I've had great discussions with Mark when I'll say, well, you know, in the putting stroke, we don't want our pelvis to move. And, you know, he's like, you know, anatomically, that's not possible. When you move your big toe, your eyebrow moves because it's the longest, whatever it is. Yeah. And he starts going about people want to, repeat it. And even when you're standing still, you're moving because the world's moving, postural sway, and starts going. Yeah. So it's, that's pretty cool. Good.
One of the main things that I've been thinking about since my presentation was one of the people that were marking my exam in my presentation. They said, well, how will this influence golf coaching? So what do we do differently? And it's a really great question. But, you know, there's a golf coach out there called Adam Young, and he put a tweet out the other day, and he said, adaptability will beat consistency. Do you know what I mean? So we want to be adaptable in our movements and in our skills, and we don't want to be consistent. I think that pretty much sums up kind of my thoughts at the minute on how to practice. And there's still a lot of players out there, aspiring players or club golfers, that are just, you know, they're having a chip and they're trying to remember the lesson that they had 2 weeks ago that's in the driving range on Full Swing. Instead of having a look for the cues in the environment and playing a shot that solves the problem that's out in front of them. So even watching the Masters and Phil Mickelson just chatting when he was warming up on the practice ground, he would hit a different flighted shot, one low, one high, you know, one spinny, one not so spinny, just as he was chatting. I can't remember who he was chatting to. And I've also fallen into the trap of trying to look for the chipping technique. Hmm. You know, what is the chipping technique? And you just get tied some knots now, realize that there is no one chipping technique. Really interesting.
It's interesting.
There's another one more thing. I think there was there's another fella. I follow a lot of physios nowadays on Instagram and Twitter. And there's a quite outspoken one called Adam Meekins, and he is on a rant about pain at the moment, because pain's a big thing for physios, and it's and somebody put a tweet out regarding pain, and he said, you know, I have no idea. Often I have no idea where the pain comes from. But we'll start, you know what I mean? We'll start the process. And I think that's really important for golfers to admit to, golf coaches to admit to, that we don't really know how the swing's going to look and how, what the solution is, but we're going to work it through with you. I just thought there's some great parallels there for any aspiring coaches to look at the physio world, because there's physios out there that will say that I'll get rid of your pain in two sessions. And there's golf coaches out there that'll say, I'll sort your slice out in two golf lessons.
Yeah, food for thought. Hey, here's a question for you. Here's, Mark asked me this question, and it I couldn't answer it straight away. And that was, what is the difference between perception, reality, and truth?
Well, I know from my uni days that there's something called epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge. And there's one aspect of that paradigm would say that there's no truth, there's no single truth. And there's another paradigm that believes that there is one single truth. And that kept me awake thinking on those lines, you know, is there a single truth out there, or is it just due to the lens that you look at it from, and all the things that we are as humans, as we look at that problem through our own eyes, through our own filters. Perception is with the filters, isn't it? It's your own, you know, the perception is has the filters of the human being, or the camera, you know, TV. You've got the camera that's only seeing one aspect of that scene, and you've got the viewers who are looking at that camera of one aspect of the room through their own lens. So I don't know if that helps at all, but that's the kind of things I'd be thinking about.
I think it's just interesting it's a great question, and you know, you ask everyone and everyone's slightly different in what they say, and that's okay. I think, you know, we are, it's good. Yes. It's good, because we all do say different answers. The something for the listeners to go and have a look at regarding Tiger Woods did a practice session similar to what you're saying about the Phil Mickelson. If you type in Tiger creative practice session on the range, there's about 40-50 shots that's sped up, and he just looks like he's messing about. And like, I think where a lot of good golfers struggle, they start off as kids and they mess about. They have great fun chipping over trees, chipping under trees, trying to top it, trying to hit one at the toe, the heel, messing about, being really creative, being kids. And then when they get to a level where they think, oh, right, I'm an elite golfer now, I'm a good golfer, so I better get my, you know, better get my putting mat out, and got to stand there and for hours on the putting mat, and I've got to go on the range and get my, I don't know, shallow that shaft with a stick, or I don't know what the long game wankers do, but I just swore. I told you not to swear at the start of this, didn't I? Where am I going with this? Yeah, so kids get, they start off creative, and then they get all sort of one-dimensional. They grow up, but they lose the art and the skill of, you know, being a kid. And I think that makes you more skillful. You know, I know my chipping action, I can't imagine I've ever done the same thing twice. Like, I mess about so much with it, and I still love chipping for that area, because I can just be so creative, not one-dimensional. So the point I'm trying to make is, like, adults and good players, they need to still be kids, mess about. Creative practice for me needs to be 30, it depends on the individual, but a third of a third of your practice needs to be creative, hitting one out of the toe, one out of the heel, one out of the center. And that's Adam Young's theory. You know, he's down that line, isn't he? And Aaron, look, that's been a fun discussion tonight. Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Hopefully you have. And hopefully if somebody hasn't fallen asleep and they're still listening, thank you. Hopefully they've enjoyed it and took a couple of nuggets away from that call. And yeah, great, great stuff. Keep learning. I think that's like one thing I like about you, Aaron. And there's many things I like about you. My stock car friend going to Buxton. But one thing I like is that a lot of people have their opinions, but they don't have anything to back it up. And what you've done with your masters is you've tested it. So if someone said, no, you've got to be the same at chipping, like you can turn around and say, look, I've done the research. Like, unless you don't think my research is right, then go and do something better. So it's like, it's good. That's evolving. So I like that you're still learning. And, you're doing a great job there at Morley Hayes, that the kids, the academy, you know, that those guys who I come up and see a couple of times a year, they're in a wonderful learning environment. They're very fortunate to have you. And, please keep doing what you're doing.
Much appreciated, Ollie. Keep this podcast going, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.